"We'll practice all week," said Galdo. "We'll be robbing you blind," said Locke, "by the next Idler's Day."
"I don't think so," said Chains, chuckling, "since I'm sending you off on a 3-month apprenticeship on Penance Day."
"You're what?"
"Remember last year when I sent Carlo off to Lashane to pretend to be an initiate in the Order of Gandolo, and Galdo went to Ashmere to slip into the Order of Sendovani? Well, your turn's come. You'll be going up the river to be a farmer for a few months."
"A farmer?"
"Yes, you might have heard of them." Chains gathered the cards from around the table and shuffled them. "They're where our food comes from."
"Yes, but I don't know anything about farming."
"Of course not. You didn't know how to cook, serve, dress like a gentleman, or speak Vadran when I bought you either. So now you're going to learn something else new."
"Where?"
"Up the Angevine, 7 or 8 miles. Little place called Villa Senziano. It's tenant farmers, mostly beholden to the Duke or some of the minor swells from the Alcigrante. I'll dress as a priest of Dama Elisa, and you'll be my initiate, being sent off to work the earth as part of your service to the goddess. It's what they do."
"But I don't know anything about the Order of Dama Elisa."
"You won't need to. The man you'll be staying with understands that you're one of my little bastards. The story's just for everyone else."
"What," said Carlo, "are we going to do in the meantime?"
"You'll mind the temple. I'll only be gone 2 days. The eyeless priest can be sick and locked away in his chambers. Don't sit the steps while I'm away. People always get sympathetic if I'm out of sight for a bit, especially if I cough and hack when I return. You two and Jean can amuse yourselves as you see fit, so long as you don't make a bloody mess of the place."
"By the time I get back," said Locke, "I'll be the worst card player in the temple." "Yes, best wishes for a safe journey, Locke," said Carlo. "Savour the country air," said Galdo. "Stay as long as you like."
2. The 5 towers loomed over Camor like the upstretched hand of a god. 5 irregular, soaring, elderglass cylinders, dotted with turrets and spires and walkways, and much curious evidence that the creatures that had designed them did not quite share the aesthetic sense of the humans who'd appropriated them. Easternmost was Dawncatcher, 400 feet high, its natural colour a shimmery silver red, like the reflection of a sunset sky in a still body of water. Behind it was Blackspear, slightly taller, made of an obsidian glass that shone with broken rainbows like a pool of oil. At the far side, as one might reckon by looking across the 5 with Dawncatcher in the middle of one's vision, was Westwatch, which shone with the soft violet of a tourmaline, shot through with veins of snow-white pearl. Beside it was stately Amberglass, with its elaborate flutings from which the wind would pull eerie melodies. In the middle, tallest and grandest of all, was Raven's Reach, the palace of Duke Nicovante, which gleamed like molten silver and was crowned with the famous sky garden, whose lowest-hanging vine trailed in the air some 600 feet above the ground. A network of glassine cables, miles and miles of spun elderglass cords had been found in the tunnels beneath Camor centuries before, threaded the roofs and turret tops of the 5 towers. Hanging baskets passed back and forth on these cables, drawn along by servants at huge clacking capstans. These baskets carried both passengers and cargo. Although many of the residents of Lower Camor proclaimed them mad, the nobles of the 5 families regarded the lurching, bobbing passage across the yawning empty spaces as a test of honour and courage. Here and there, large cargo cages were being drawn up or lowered from jutting platforms on several of the towers. They reminded Locke, who stared up at all this with eyes that were not yet sated with such wonders, of the spider cages at the Palace of Patience. He and Chains sat in a two-wheeled cart with a little walled space behind the seat, where Chains had stashed several parcels of goods under an old canvas tarp. Chains wore the loose brown robes with green and silver trim that marked a priest of Dama Eliza, mother of rains and reaping. Locke wore a plain tunic and breeches, without shoes. Chains had their two horses, ungentled, for Chains misliked using the white-eyed creatures outside city walls, trotting at a gentle pace up the winding cobbles of the Street of Seven Wheels, the heart of the Mill Falls district. In truth, there were more than seven wheels spinning in the white froth of the Angevine. There were more in sight than Locke could count. The five towers had been built on a plateau some 60-odd feet above the lower city. The Alchigrante Islands sloped up toward the base of this plateau. The Angevine came into Camor at that height, just to the east of the five, and fell down a crashing six-story waterfall nearly 200 yards across. Wheels turned at the top of these falls, within a long glass-and-stone bridge topped with wooden mill-houses. Wheels turned beneath the falls as well, jutting out into the river on both sides, making use of the rushing white flow to work everything from grinding stones to the bellows that blew air across the fires beneath brewers' vats. It was a district choked with business folk and labourers alike, with escorted nobles in gilded carriages rolling here and there to inspect their holdings or place orders. They turned east at the tip of the Mill Falls and crossed a wide, low bridge into the Chenza Gate district, the means by which most northbound land traffic left the city. There was a great mess, barely controlled by a small army of yellow jackets. Caravans of wagons were rolling into the city, their drivers at the mercy of the Duke's tax and customs agents, men and women marked by their tall black brimless caps, and commonly referred to, when out of earshot, as vexationers. Petty merchants were pitching everything from warm beer to cooked carrots. Beggars were pleading countless improbable reasons for impoverishment and claiming lingering wounds from wars that had obviously ended long before they were born. Yellow jackets were driving the most persistent or malodorous off with their black lacquered sticks. It was not yet the 10th hour of the morning. "You should see this place around noon," said Chains, "especially during harvest time, and when it rains. Gods!" Chain's clerical vestments and a silver solon passed over in a handshake got them out of the city with little more than a "Good day, Your Holiness." The Chenza Gate was 15 yards wide, with huge ironwood doors almost as tall. The guardhouses on the wall were occupied, barracks-like, not just by the city watch, but by the blackjackets, Camor's regular soldiers. They could be seen pacing here and there atop the wall, which was a good 20 feet thick. North of Camor proper was neighbourhood after neighbourhood of lightly built stone and wooden buildings, arranged in courts and squares more airy than those found on the islands of the city itself. Along the riverbank there were the beginnings of a marsh. To the north and east were terraced hills, crisscrossed by the white lines of boundary stones set out to mark the property of the families that farmed them. The air took on divergent qualities depending on which way the chance breezes blew. It would smell of sea salt and wood smoke one minute, of manure and olive groves the next. "Here beyond the walls," said Chains, "is what many folks living outside the great cities would think of as cities. These little scatterings of wood and stone that probably don't look like much to someone like you. Just as you haven't really seen the country, most of them haven't truly seen the city. So keep your eyes open and your mouth shut, and be mindful of differences until you've had a few days to acclimate yourself."
"What's the point of this trick, Chains, really?"
"You might one day have to pretend to be a person of very lowly station, Locke. If you learn something about being a farmer, you'll probably learn something about being a teamster, a barge poleman, a village smith, a horse physicker, and maybe even a country bandit."
The road north from Camor was an old Therinthrone road, a raised stone expanse with shallow ditches at the sides. It was covered with a gravel of pebbles and iron filings, waste from the forges of the coal-smoke district. Here and there the rains had fused or rusted the gravel into a reddish cement. The wheels clattered as they slid over these hard patches.
"A lot of black jackets," Chains said slowly, "come from the farms and villages north of Camor. It's what the Dukes of Camor do when they need more men, and they can afford to wait a bit without raising a general levy of the low-born. It's good wages, and there's the promise of land for those that stay in service a full 25 years, assuming they don't get killed, of course. They come from the north, and mostly they go back to the north."
"Is that why the black jackets and the yellow jackets don't like each other?"
"Eh." Chain's eyes twinkled. "Good guess. There's some truth to it. Most of the yellow jackets are city boys that want to stay city boys. But on top of that, soldiers can be some of the cattiest, most clannish damn folk you'll ever find outside of a high-born lady's wardrobe. They'll fight over anything. They'll brawl over the colours of their hats and the shapes of their shoes. I know, believe me."
"You pretended to be one once?"
13 gods, no. I was one."
"A black jacket?"
"Yes."
Chains sighed and settled back against the hard wooden seat of the horse cart. 30 years
passed now. More than 30. I was a pikeman for the old Duke Nicovante. Most of us from the village my age went. It was a bad time for wars. Duke needed fodder. We needed food and coin."
"Which village?"
Chains favoured him with a crooked smile.
"Villa Senziano." "Gods, it was a whole pile of us that went."
The horses and the cart rattled down the road for a few long moments before Chains continued.
"There were 3 of us that came back, or at least got out of it."
"Only 3?
"That I know of."
Chains scratched at his beard.
"One of them is the man I'm going to be leaving you with, Vandross. A good fellow, not book-smart, but very wise in the everyday sense. He did his 25 years, and the Duke gave him a spot of land as a tenancy."
"Tenancy?"
"Most common folk outside the city don't own their own land any more than city renters own their buildings. An old soldier with a tenancy gets a nice spot of land to farm until he dies. It's a sort of allowance from the Duke."
Chains chuckled.
"Given in exchange for one's youth and health."
"You didn't do the 25, I'm guessing."
"No."
Chains fiddled with his beard a bit more, an old nervous gesture.
"Damn, I wish I could have a smoke. It's a very frowned-on thing in the order of the Dharma, mind you. No, I took sick after a battle. Something more than just the usual shits and sore feet. A wasting fever. I couldn't march, and I was like to die, so they left me behind. Myself and many others. In the care of some itinerant priests of Perelandro."
"But you didn't die."
"Clever lad," said Chains, "to deduce that from such slender evidence after living with me for just 3 years."
"And what happened?"
"A great many things," said Chains. "And you know how it ends. I wound up in this cart, riding north and entertaining you."
"Well, what happened to the 3rd man from your village?"
"Him? Well," said Chains, "he always had his head on right. He made Banneret sergeant not long after I got laid up with the fever. At the Battle of Nesek, he helped young Nicovante hold the line together when old Nicovante took an arrow right between his eyes. He lived, got elevated, and served Nicovante in the next few wars that came their way."
"And where is he?"
"At this very moment? How should I know? But," said Chains, "later this afternoon he'll be giving Jean Tannen his usual afternoon weapons lesson at the House of Glass Roses."
"Oh," said Locke.
"Funny old world," said Chains. Three farmers became three soldiers. Three soldiers became one farmer, one baron, and one thieving priest.
And now I'm to become a farmer for a while.
Yes, useful training indeed, but not just that.
What else?
Another test, my boy. Just another test.
Which is?
All these years you've had me looking over you. You've had Carlo and Galdo and Jean and Sabatha from time to time. You've gotten used to the temple as a home. But time's a river, Locke, and we've always drifted farther down it than we think. He smiled down at Locke with real affection. I can't stand watch on you forever, boy. Now we need to see what you can do when you're off in a strange new place all on your own.
Chapter 8. The Funeral Cask. 1. It began like this, with the slow, steady beat of mourning drums and the slow cadence of marchers moving north from the floating grave, red torches smouldering in their hands, a double line of blood-red light stretched out beneath the low, dark clouds. At its heart was Vencarlo Barsavi, cupper of Camor, with a son at either hand. Before him was a covered casket draped in black silk and cloth of gold, carried at either side by 6 pallbearers, one for each of the 12 Therin gods, dressed in black cloaks and black masks. At Barsavi's back was a huge wooden cask on a cart pulled by another 6 men, with a black-shrouded priestess of the Nameless 13th close behind. The drums echoed against stone walls, against stone streets and bridges and canals. The torches cast reflections of fire in every window and shred of elderglass they passed. Folk looked on in apprehension, if they looked on at all. Some bolted their doors and drew shutters over their windows as the funeral procession passed. This is how things are done in Camor, for the rich and the powerful. The slow, mournful march to the Hill of Whispers, the interment, the ceremony, and then the wild, tearful celebration afterward. A toast on behalf of the departed, a bittersweet revel for those not yet taken for judgment by Azaguia, Lady of the Long Silence. The funeral cask is what fuels this tradition. The lines of marchers left the wooden waste just after the 10th hour of the evening and marched into the cauldron, where no urchin or drunkard dared to get in their way, where gangs of cutthroats and gaze addicts stood in silent attention as their master and his court walked past. Through coal smoke they marched, and then north into the quiet, as silvery mist rose warm and clinging from the canals around them. Not a single yellow jacket crossed their path. Not one constable even caught sight of the procession. Arrangements had been made to keep them busy elsewhere that night. The east belonged to Barsavi and his long lines of torches, and the farther north he went, the more honest families bolted their doors and doused their lights, and prayed that the business of the marchers lay far away from them. Had there been many staring eyes, they might have noticed that the procession had already failed to turn toward the Hill of Whispers, that it had instead gone north and snaked toward the western tip of the Rust Water District, where the great abandoned structure called the Echo Hole loomed in the darkness and the fog. A curious observer might have wondered at the sheer size of the procession, more than 100 men and women, and at their accoutrements. Only the pallbearers were dressed for a funeral. The torchbearers were dressed for war, in armor of boiled leather with blackened studs, in collars and helmets and braces and gloves, with knives and clubs and axes and bucklers at their belts. They were the cream of Barsavi's gangs, the hardest of the right people, cold-eyed men and women with murders to their names. They were from all of his districts and all of his gangs, the Red Hands and the Rum Hounds, the Grey Faces and the Arsenal Boys, the Canal Jumpers and the Black Twists, the Catchfire Barons and a dozen others. The most interesting thing about the procession, however, was something no casual observer could know. The The fact was, Nazca Barsavi's body still lay in her old chambers in the floating grave, sealed away under silk sheets, alchemically impregnated to keep the rot of death from setting in too quickly. Locke Lamora and a dozen other priests of the Nameless Thirteenth, the Crooked Warden, had said prayers for her the previous night, and placed her within a circle of sacred candles, there to lie until her father finished his business this evening, which had nothing to do with the Hill of Whispers. The coffin that was draped in funeral silks was empty. 2.
"I am the Grey King," said Locke Lamora. "I am the Grey King, God's damn his eyes, I am the Grey King."
"A little lower," said Jean Tannen, struggling with one of the grey cuffs of Locke's coat, "and a little scratchier. Give it a hint of Tal Verar. You said he had an accent."
"I am the Grey King," said Locke, "and I'll be smiling out the other side of my head when the gentleman bastards are through with me." "Oh, that's good," said Carlo, who was streaking Locke's hair with a foul-scented alchemical paste that was steadily turning it charcoal grey. "I like that one. Just different enough to be noticed."
Locke stood stock still as a tailor's mannequin, surrounded by Carlo, Galdo, and Jean, who worked on him with clothes cosmetics and threaded needles. Bug leaned up against one wall of their little enclosure, keeping his eyes and ears alert for interlopers. The gentleman bastards were hidden away in an abandoned storefront in the fog-choked Rustwater district, just a few blocks north of the Echo Hole. Rustwater was a dead island, ill-favored and barely inhabited. A city that had thrown off its old prejudices about the structures of the Eldrin still held Rustwater in an unequivocal dread. It was said that the black shapes that moved in the Rustwater lagoon were nothing as pleasant as mere man-eating sharks, but something worse, something older. Whatever the truth of those rumors, it was a conveniently deserted place for Barsavi and the Grey King to play out their strange affair. Locke privately suspected that he'd been taken somewhere in this neighborhood on the night the Grey King had first interrupted his life. They were working every trick of their masquerade art to fashion Locke into the Grey King. Already his hair was grey, his clothes were grey, he was dressed in heavy padded boots that added 2 inches to his height, and he had a drooping grey moustache firmly affixed above his lips.
"It looks good," said Bug, an approving note in his voice.
"Damn showy, but Bug's right," said Jean. "Now that I've got this stupid coat cinched in to your proper size, you do look rather striking."
"Pity this isn't one of our games," said Galdo. "I'd be enjoying myself. Lean forward for some wrinkles, Locke."
Working very carefully, Galdo painted Locke's face with a warm, waxy substance that pinched his skin as it went on. In seconds it dried and tightened, and in just a few moments Locke had a complete network of crow's feet, laugh lines, and forehead wrinkles. He looked to be in his mid-40s at the very least. The disguise would have done very well in the bright light of day. At night it would be impenetrable.
"Virtuoso," said Jean. "Relatively speaking, for such short notice and the conditions we have in which to put it all together."
Locke flipped his hood up and pulled on his grey leather gloves.
"I am the Grey King," he said,
his voice low, mimicking the odd accent of the real Grey King.
"I bloody well believe it," said Bug.
"Well, let's get on with everything then."
Locke moved his jaw up and down, feeling the false wrinkle skin stretch back and forth as he did so.
"Galdo, hand me my stilettos, would you? I think I'll want one in my boot and one in my sleeve."
"Lamora,"
came a cold whisper, the falconer's voice. Locke tensed, then realized that the noise hadn't come from the air.
"What is it?" asked Jean.
"It's the falconer," said Locke. He's doing that damned thing."
"Barsavi will soon be at hand. You and your friends must be in place ere long."
"We have an impatient bondsmage," said Locke. "Quickly now. Bug, you know the game, and you know where to put yourself."
"I've got it down cold," said Bug, grinning. "Don't even have a temple roof to jump off this time. so don't worry about anything.
Jean, you're comfortable with your place?
Not really, but there's none better.
Jean cracked his knuckles. I'll be in sight of Bug down beneath the floor. If the whole thing goes to shit, you just remember to throw yourself down the damn waterfall. I'll cover your back, the sharp and bloody way.
Carlo, Galdo.
Locke whirled to face the twins, who had hurriedly packed away all the tools and substances used to dress Locke up for the evening.
Are we good to move at the temple?
It'll be smoother than a gilded lily's backside if we do, said Galdo. A sweet fat fortune wrapped up in sacks, two carts with horses, provisions for a nice long trip on the road. And there's men at the Viscount's gate who'll slip us out so fast, it'll be like we'd never even set foot in Camor in the first place, added Carlo.
Good. Well, shit.
Locke rubbed his gloved hands together. I guess that's that. I'm all out of rhetorical flourishes, so let's just go get the bastards and pray for a straight deal.
Bug stepped forward and cleared his throat.
I'm only doing this, he said, because I really love hiding in haunted Eldrin buildings on dark and creepy nights.
You're a liar, said Jean slowly. I'm only doing this because I've always wanted to see Bug get eaten by an Eldrin ghost.
Liar, said Carlo. I'm only doing this because I fucking love hauling half a ton of bloody coins up out of a vault and packing them away on a cart. Liar, Galdo chuckled. I'm only doing this because while you're all busy elsewhere, I'm going to pawn all the furniture in the borough at No Hope Hawser's.
You're all liars,
said Locke as their eyes turned expectantly to him.
We're only doing this because nobody else in Camor is good enough to pull this off, and nobody else is dumb enough to get stuck doing it in the first place.
Bastard! They shouted in unison, forgetting their surroundings for a bare moment.
I can hear you shouting, came the ghostly voice of the falconer. Have you all gone completely mad?
Locke sighed. Uncle doesn't like us keeping him up all night with our carrying on, he said.
Let's get to it, and by the grace of the crooked warden, we'll all see each other back at the temple when this mess is over.
3. The echo hole is a cube of grey stone mortared with a dull sort of elder glass. It never gleams at false light. In fact, it never returns the reflection of any light passed before it. It is perhaps 100 feet on a side, with one dignified entrance, a man-sized door about 20 feet above the street at the top of a wide staircase. A single aqueduct cuts from the upper Angevine past the mill falls, south at an angle and into Rustwater, where it spills its water into the heart of the echo hole. Like the stone cube itself, this aqueduct is thought to be touched by some ancient ill, and no use has ever been made of it. A small waterfall plunges through a hole in the floor, down into the catacombs beneath the echo hole, where dark water can be heard rushing. Some of these passages empty into the canal on the southwestern side of Rustwater. Some empty into no place known to living men. Locke Lamora stood in darkness at the center of the echo hole, listening to the rush of water down the break in the floor, staring fixedly at the patch of greyness that marked the door to the street. His only consolation was that Jean and Bug, crouched unseen in the wet darkness beneath the floor, would probably be even more apprehensive, at least until the proceedings started.
Near, came the voice of the falconer. Very near. Stand ready.
Locke heard the cuppa's procession before he saw it. The sound of funeral drums came through the open door to the street, muffled and nearly drowned out by the falling water. Steadily it grew louder. A red glow seemed to kindle beyond the door, and by that light Locke saw that the grey mist had thickened. Torches flickered softly, as though glimpsed from underwater. The red aura rose. The barest outline of the room around him became visible, etched in faint carmine. The beating of the drum ceased, and once again Locke was alone with the sound of the waterfall. He threw back his head, placed one hand behind his back, and stared at the door,
his blood pounding in his ears. Two small red fires appeared in the doorway like the eyes of a dragon from one of Jean's stories. Black shadows moved behind them, and as Locke's eyes adjusted to the influx of scarlet light, he saw the faces of men, tall men, cloaked and armored. He could see enough of their features and posture to see that they were almost surprised to spot him. They hesitated, then continued forward, one moving to his left and the other to his right. For his part, he did nothing, moving not a muscle. Two more torches followed, and then two more. Barsavi was sending his men up the stairs in pairs. Soon a loose semicircle of men faced Locke, and their torches cast the interior of the echo hole into red-shaded relief. There were carvings on the walls, strange old symbols in the tongue of the Eldrin, which men had never deciphered. A dozen men, two dozen. The crowd of armored shapes grew, and Locke saw faces that he recognized. Throat-slitters, leg-breakers, maulers, assassins. A hard lot. Exactly what Barsavi had promised him when they'd stood looking down at the body of Nazca together. Moments passed. Still Locke said nothing. Still men and women filed in. The Barangia sisters, even in a dimmer light, Locke would have recognized their swagger. They stood at front and center of the gathering crowd, saying nothing, arms folded and eyes gleaming in the torchlight. By some unspoken command, none of Barsavi's people moved behind Locke. He continued to stand alone, as the great press of right people continued spreading before him. At last, the crowd of cutthroats began to part. Locke could hear the echoes of their breathing and murmuring and the creaking of their leathers bouncing from wall to wall, mingling with the sound of falling water. Some of those on the edges of the crowd extinguished their torches with wet leather pouches. Gradually the smell of smoke seeped into the air, and gradually the light sank, until perhaps one in five of the Kappa's folk were still holding lit fires. There was more than enough light to see Kappa Barsavi as he turned the corner and stepped through the door. His grey hair was pulled back in oiled rows. His three beards were freshly brushed. He wore his coat of sharkskin leather and a black cloak of velvet lined with cloth of gold, thrown back from one shoulder. Andres was on his right and Panchero on his left as the Kappa strode forward, and in the reflected fires of their eyes Locke saw nothing but death.
"Nothing is as it seems," came the voice of the falconer. "Stand resolute."
At the front of the crowd, Barsavi halted, and for a long moment he stared at the apparition before him, at the cool orange eyes with a shadowed hood, at Locke's cloak and mantle and coat and gloves of grey.
"King,"
he finally said.
"Kappa,"
Locke replied, willing himself to feel the hauteur, conjuring it forth from nothing, the sort of man who would stand in front of 100 killers with a smile on his face, the sort of man who would summon Vencarlo Barsavi with a trail of corpses, the last of them his only daughter. That was the man Locke needed to be, not Nazca's friend, but her murderer, not the Kappa's mischievous subject, but his equal, his superior. Locke grinned, wolfishly, then swept his cloak back from his left shoulder. With his left hand he beckoned the Kappa, a taunting gesture, like a bully in an alley, daring his opponent to step forward and take the first swing.
"Oblige him,"
said the Kappa, and a dozen men and women raised crossbows. "Crooked warden," thought Locke, "give me strength." He ground his teeth in expectation. He could hear his jaw muscles creaking. The snap hiss of release echoed throughout the hall. A dozen taut strings twanged. The bolts were too fast to follow, dark afterimages that blurred the air, and then a dozen narrow black shapes rebounded off nothing right before his face and fell clattering to the floor, scattered in an arc like dead birds at his feet. Locke laughed, a high and genuine sound of pleasure. For one brief moment he would have kissed the falconer if the bondsmage had stood before him.
"Please," he said, "I thought you'd listen to the stories."
"'Just establishing your bona fides,' said Kappa Barsavi. "'Your Majesty!'
The last word was sneered. Locke had at least expected a certain wariness following the blunting of the crossbow attack, but Barsavi stepped forward without apparent fear.
"'I'm pleased that you've answered my summons,' Locke replied. "'The blood of my daughter is the only thing that summoned me,' said Barsavi.
"'Dwell on it, if you must,'
said Locke, praying silently as he extemporized. "'Nazca, gods, please forgive me.'
"'Were you any gentler when you took this city for yourself 22 years ago?' "'Is that what you think you're doing?'
Barsavi stopped and stared at him. They were about 40 feet apart.
"'Taking my city from me? "'I summoned you to discuss the matter of Camor,' said Locke, "'to settle it to our mutual satisfaction.'
The falconer hadn't interrupted him yet. He presumed he was doing well.
"'The satisfaction,' said Barsavi, "'will not be mutual.'
He raised his left hand, and one man stepped from the crowd. Locke peered at this man carefully. He seemed to be an older fellow, slight and balding, and he wasn't wearing armor. Very curious. He also appeared to be shivering.
"'Do as we discussed, Aimon,' said the Kappa. "'I'll hold true to my bargain, truer than any I've ever made.'
The unarmored man began to walk forward, slowly, hesitantly, staring at Locke with obvious fear. But still he kept coming, straight toward Locke, while 100 armed men and women waited behind him, doing nothing.
"'I pray,' said Locke, with a bantering tone, "'That man isn't contemplating what I suspect.' "'We'll all see what his business is soon enough,' said the Kappa. "'I cannot be cut or pierced,' said Locke, "'and this man will die at my touch.' "'So it's been said,' replied the Kappa.
Aimon continued to move forward. He was 30 feet from Locke, then 20.
"'Aimon!' said Locke. "'You are being ill-used. Stop now!'
"'Gods,' he thought, "'don't do what I think you're going to do. Don't make the falconer kill you.' Aimon continued to shamble forward. His jowls were quivering, and he was breathing in short, sharp gasps. His hands were out before him, shaking like a man about to reach into a fire. "'Crooked warden,' Locke thought. "'Please, let him be scared. Please let him stop. Falconer, falconer, please put a fright into him. Do anything else but kill him.' A river of sweat ran down his spine. He bent his head slightly and fixed Aimon with a stare. 10 feet now lay between them.
"'Aimon,'
he said, striving for a casual tone and not entirely succeeding,
"'you have been warned.' You are in mortal peril.
Oh, yeah, said the man, his voice quavering. Yeah, that I know.
And then he closed the distance between them, and he reached out for Locke's right arm with both of his hands. Fuck, thought Locke, and although he knew deep down that it would be the falconer killing the man and not himself, he flinched back from Aimon's touch. Aimon's eyes lit up. He gasped, and then, to Locke's horror, he leapt forward and grabbed Locke's arm with both of his hands, like a scavenger bird clutching at a long-delayed meal.
"'Ah!'
he cried, and for one brief second Locke thought something terrible was happening to him. But no, Aimon still lived, and he had a very firm grip. "'Double fuck!' Locke mumbled, bringing up his left fist to clout the poor fellow, but he was off balance, and Aimon had him at a disadvantage. The slender man gave Locke a shove backward, screaming once again,
"Ah!"
A cry of absolute triumph. Locke puzzled over it as he fell flat on his ass. And then there were booted feet slapping the stones behind Aimon, and dark shapes rushing around him to grab at Locke. In the dancing light cast by 24 moving torches, Locke found himself hauled back up to his feet, pinned by strong hands that clutched at his arms and his shoulders and his neck. Kappa Barsavi pushed through his eager crowd of men and women, forced Iman more gently to the side, and stood face to face with Locke, his fat, ruddy features alight with anticipation.
"Well, Your Majesty," he said, "I'll bet you're one confused son of a bitch right about now."
And then Barsavi's people were laughing, cheering. And then the copper's ham-hock fist planted itself in Locke's stomach, and the air rushed out of his lungs, and black pain exploded in his chest. And then he knew just how deeply in the shit he truly was. 4.
"Yes, I'll bet you're pretty goddamned curious at this point," said Barsavi, strutting back and forth in front of Locke,
who remained pinioned by 6 men, any one of them half again his size.
"And so am I. Let's throw that hood back, boys."
Rough hands yanked at Locke's hood and mantle, and the Kappa stared coldly at him, running one hand up and down his beards.
"Grey, grey, grey. You look like you belong on a stage," he laughed. "And such a skinny fellow, too. What a weak little man we've caught ourselves tonight. The Grey King, sovereign of fog and shadows and precious little else."
The Kappa backhanded him, grinning. The stinging pain had just registered when he did it again from the other direction. Locke's head lolled. He was grabbed from behind by his hair and made to look the Kappa right in the face. Locke's thoughts whirled. Had the Kappa's men somehow located the falconer? Had they distracted him? Was the Kappa mad enough to actually kill a bondsmage if he had the chance?
"Oh, we know you can't be cut," continued Barsavi. "And we know you can't be pierced, more's the pity. But bruised? It's a curious thing about the spells of a bondsmage. They're so damn specific, aren't they?"
And then he punched Locke in the stomach again, to a murmur of widespread amusement. Locke's knees buckled beneath him, and his attendants hoisted him again, holding him upright as bolts of pain radiated from his abdomen.
"One of your men," said Barsavi, "strolled into my floating grave this very morning."
A little chill crept down Locke's spine.
"Seems I'm not the only one you pissed off when you sent my Nazca back to me the way you did," said Barsavi, leering. "Seems that some of your men didn't sign on with your merry little crew for that sort of god's damn desecration. So your man and I, we had ourselves a talk, and we fixed a price. And then he told me all sorts of fascinating things about that spell of yours, and that story about you being able to kill men with a touch. Oh, he told me it was bullshit."
"Sewn up," said a little voice at the back of Locke's head that most certainly was not the falconer. "Sewn up, sewn up." Of course the falconer hadn't been distracted or taken by any of Barsavi's men. Neat as a god's damned hanging.
"But I was only willing to trust the fellow so far," Barsavi said. "So I made a deal with Iman, who I'm sure you don't recognize. Iman is dying. He has the cold consumption, the tumors in his stomach and his back, the sort no physica can cure. He's got maybe 2 months, maybe less."
The Kappa clapped Iman on the back as proudly as if the skinny man were his own flesh and blood.
"So I said, why don't you step up and grab the filthy little bastard, Iman? If you really can kill with a touch, well, you'll go quick and easy. And if he can't..."
Barsavi grinned, his red cheeks wrinkling grotesquely.
"Well, then, 1,000 full crowns," said Iman, giggling. "For starters," added Barsavi, "a promise I intend to keep, a promise I intend to expand. I told Aemon he'd die in his own villa, with gems and silks and half a dozen ladies of his choice from the Gilded Lilies to keep him company. I will invent pleasures for him. He'll die like a fucking duke, because tonight I name him the bravest man in Camor.
There was a general roar of approval. Men and women applauded, and fists banged on armor and shields.
"Quite the opposite," Barsavi whispered, "of a sneaking, cowardly piece of shit who would murder my only daughter, who wouldn't even do it with his own hands, who'd let some fucking hireling work a twisted magic on her, a poisoner."
Barsavi spat in Locke's face. The warm spittle trickled down his cheek.
"Your man told me, of course, that your bondsmage had set his spell and left your services last night. That you were so very confident you didn't want to keep paying him. Well, I, for one, applaud your sense of economy."
Barsavi gestured to Andres and Pachero. Grim-faced, the two men stepped forward. They slipped their optics off and put them in vest pockets, an ominous gesture conducted in unconscious unison. Locke opened his mouth to say something, and then the realization of exactly how sewn up he was struck him cold. He could proclaim his true identity, have the Kappa tear off his false moustache and rub away the wrinkles, spill the entire story, but what would it gain him? He would never be believed. He'd already displayed a bondsmage's protection. If he confessed to being Locke Lamora, the 100 men and women here would be after Jean and Bug and the Sansas next. If he was going to save them, he had to play the Grey King until the Kappa was finished with him, and then he would pray for a quick and easy death. Let Locke Lamora just vanish one night. Let his friends slip away to whatever better fate awaited them. Blinking back hot tears, he summoned up a grin, looked at the two Barsavi sons, and said,
"By all means, you fucking curs. Let's see if you can do any better than your father."
Andres and Pachero knew how to strike a man with the intent to kill, but just now they had no such intent. They bruised his ribs, knuckle-punched his arms, kicked his thighs, slapped his head from side to side, and punched him in the neck until every breath was a chore. At last Andres had him hoisted back up and took hold of his chin so that the two of them were looking eye to eye.
"By the way," said Andres, "this is from Locke Lamora."
Andres balanced Locke's chin on one finger and walloped him with his other hand. White-hot pain shot through Locke's neck, and in the red-tinted darkness around him he saw stars. He spat blood, coughed, and licked his sore, swollen lips.
"Now," said Barsavi, "I'll have a father's justice for Nazca's death."
He clapped his hands three times. Behind him there was an audible noise of men cursing and heavy footfalls banging against the stone steps. Through the door came eight more men, carrying a large wooden cask, a cask the size of the one Nazca Barsavi had been returned to her father in, the funeral cask. The crowd around Barsavi and his sons parted eagerly to let the cask haulers through. They set it on the ground beside the Kappa, and inside it Locke heard the slosh of liquid.
"Oh, 13 gods," he thought.
"Can't be cut, can't be pierced," said the Kappa, as though he were musing out loud. "But you can certainly be bruised, and you certainly need to breathe."
Two of the Kappa's men popped the lid on the cask open, and Locke was dragged over to it. The eye-watering stench of horse urine spilled out into the air, and he gagged, sobbing.
"Look at the Grey King cry," whispered Barsavi. "Look at the Grey King sob. A sight I will treasure to the last hour of my dying day."
His voice rose.
"Did Nazca sob? Did my daughter cry as you gave her her death? Somehow I don't think so."
The Kappa was shouting now.
"Take a last look. He gets what Nazca got. He dies as she died, but by my hand.
Barsavi seized Locke by the hair and tilted his face toward the barrel. For one brief, irrational moment, Locke was grateful that there was nothing in his stomach to throw up. The dry retching still brought spasms of pain to his much-abused stomach muscles.
"With one small touch," said the copper,
actually gulping back sobs of exhilaration.
"With one small touch, you son of a bitch! No poison for you. No quick way out before I put you in. You get to taste it the whole time, all the while as you drown in it."
And then he hefted Locke by the mantle, grunting. His men joined in, and together they hoisted him up over the rim, and then down he plunged, face first, down into thick, lukewarm filth that blotted out the noise of the world around him, down into darkness that burned his eyes and his cuts and swallowed him whole. 5. Barsavi's men slammed the lid back onto the barrel. Several of them hammered it down with mallets and axe butts until it was cinched tight. The copper gave the top of the barrel a thump with his fist and smiled broadly. Tears were still running down his cheeks.
"Somehow I don't think the poor fucker did as well as he hoped with our negotiations."
The men and women around him whooped and hollered, arms in the air, torches waving and casting wild shadows on the walls.
"Take this bastard and send him out to sea," said the copper, gesturing toward the waterfall.
A dozen pairs of eager hands grabbed at the barrel. Laughing and joking, a crowd of the copper's people hoisted it and carried it over to the northwestern corner of the echo hole, where water poured in from the ceiling and vanished into blackness through a fissure about 8 feet wide.
"One," said the leader, "two,"
and on the cusp of "three," they flung the barrel down into darkness. It struck water somewhere beneath them with a splash. Then they threw up their arms and began cheering once again.
"Tonight," cried Barsavi, "Duke Nicovante sleeps safe in his bed, locked away in his glass tower. Tonight the Grey King sleeps in piss, in a tomb that I have made for him. Tonight is my night. Who rules Camor?" "Barsavi," came the response from every throat in the echo hole,
reverberating around the alien-set stones of the structure, and the kappa was surrounded by a sea of noise, laughter, applause.
"Tonight," he yelled, "send messengers to every corner of my domains. Send runners to the last mistake. Send runners to catch fire. Wake the cauldron and the narrows and the dregs and all the snare. Tonight I throw open my doors. The right people of Camor will come to the floating grave as my guests. Tonight we'll have such a revel that the honest folk will bar their doors, that the yellow jackets will cringe in their barracks, that the gods themselves will look down and cry, 'What is that fucking racket?' Barsavi, Barsavi, Barsavi," his people chanted. "Tonight," he said at last, "we will celebrate. Tonight Camor has seen the last of kings."
Interlude. The Half-Crown War. 1. As time went by, Locke and the other gentleman bastards were occasionally set free to roam at leisure, dressed in ordinary clothing. Locke and Jean were getting on near 12. The Sansas were visibly slightly older. It was more difficult to keep them cooped up beneath the house of Perelandro all the time, when they weren't sitting the steps or away on Father Chain's apprenticeships. Slowly but steadily, Chains was sending his boys out to be initiated in all the great temples of the other 11 Therin gods. One of them would enter a temple under a false name, sped along by whatever strings Chains could pull and whatever palms he could slip coins into. Once there, the young gentleman bastard would inevitably please his superiors with his scribing, his theological knowledge, his discipline, and his sincerity. Advancement came quickly, as fast as it could be had. Soon the newcomer would receive training in what was called interior ritual, the phrases and activities that priests only shared among themselves and their initiates. They were not quite secrets, these things. To any priest of a Therin order, the thought of someone being audacious enough to offend the gods by falsely seeking initiation was utterly alien. Even those who knew of the slightly heretical idea of the 13th, and even the minority who actually believed in him, failed to imagine that anyone would want to do what Chains and his boys were doing. Invariably, after several months of excellent accomplishments, each sterling young initiate would die in a sudden accident. Carlo favored drowning, for he could hold his breath a very long time, and he enjoyed swimming underwater. Galdo preferred to simply disappear, preferably during a storm or some other dramatic event. Locke constructed elaborate little mummeries that took weeks to plan. On one occasion he vanished from the Order of Nara, plague mistress, lady of ubiquitous maladies, by leaving his initiate's robe, torn apart and splashed with rabbit's blood, wrapped around his copywork and a few letters in an alley behind the temple. Thus enlightened, each boy would return and teach the others of what he had seen and heard.
"The point," said Chains, "is not to make you all candidates for the High Conclave of the 12, but to allow you to throw on whatever robes and masks are required, and pass as a priest for any short period of need. When you're a priest, people tend to see the robe rather than the man."
But there was no apprenticeship underway at the moment. Jean was drilling at the House of Glass Roses, and the other boys waited for him on the southern edge of the shifting market, on a crumbling stone pier at the end of a short alley. It was a warm spring day, breezy and fresh, with the sky half occluded by crescents of grey and white clouds sweeping in from the northwest, heralding storms. Locke and Carlo and Galdo were watching the results of a collision between a chicken seller's boat and a transporter of cats. Several cages had flown open when the small boats cracked against one another, and now agitated merchants were stepping warily back and forth as the battle between birds and felines progressed. A few chickens had escaped into the water and were flapping uselessly in little circles, squawking, for nature had conspired to make them even worse at swimming than they were at flying.
"Well," said a voice behind them, "have a look at this. These little wasters seem very likely."
Locke and the Sansas turned around as one to see a half-dozen boys and girls their own age standing behind them, spread out across the alley. They were dressed much as the gentleman bastards were, in unassuming clothes of common cut. Their apparent leader had a thick, dark mane of curly black hair, pulled behind him and tied with a black silk ribbon. Quite a mark of distinction for an urchin.
"Are you friends of the friends, lads? Are you the right sort of people?"
The leader of the newcomers stood with his hands on his hips. Behind him, a short girl made several hand gestures used for common identification by Kappa Barsavi's subjects.
"We are friends of the friends," said Locke. "The rightest sort of right," added Galdo, making the appropriate counter-gestures. "Good lads. We're the seconds to the full crowns in the Narrows. Call ourselves half-crowns. What's your allegiance?"
"Gentlemen bastards," said Locke. "Temple district."
"Who are you seconds to?"
"We're not seconds to anyone," said Galdo. "It's just the gentlemen bastards, one and all."
"Savvy," said the leader of the half-crowns, with a friendly grin. "I'm Tesso Valanti. This is my crew. We're here to take your coin, unless you want to kneel and give us your preference."
Locke scowled. Preference, in the parlance of the right people, meant that the gentleman bastards would proclaim the half-crowns the better, tougher gang, make way for them on the street and tolerate whatever abuse the half-crowns saw fit to heap upon them.
"I'm Locke Lamora," said Locke as he rose slowly to his feet. "And accepting the kappa, the gentleman bastards bend the knee to nobody."
"Really?"
Tesso feigned shock.
"Even with 6-on-3?
It's soft talk, if knows your answer."
"You must not hear very well,"
said Carlo, as he and his brother stood up in unison. "He said you get our preference when you pick the peas out of our shit and suck on them for dinner."
"Now that was uncalled for," said Tesso. "So I'm going to make some noise with your skulls."